Good morning. It's good to see everybody this morning. We have a number of visitors with us today. We're certainly grateful for your presence. We are studying a survey of the history and geography of the Bible lands. We're doing this in preparation for starting a more detailed four-year or so study, three and a half, four years, a detailed study of the Bible story, where our emphasis will be on understanding the Bible story from the very beginning all the way to the very end in terms of how the Bible is organized. It seems like a lot of people grow up having studied the Bible and studied specific books, but never have really emphasized the fact that it is one continuous story. And that will be our emphasis, Lord willing, starting in the month of November. But in preparation for that, we are surveying, in addition to some other things, this book that was created by the Waldrons years ago, History and Geography of the Bible Story. So we're sort of kind of doing a condensed study of that, and where we're studying some of the Bible lands, some of the empires, the people that were comprised of the various empires that existed during that time. So that will be our emphasis. That is our emphasis today. Let me see here. Oh, I need to turn this on, don't I? All right, so we organize the story into 17 periods. Nothing magical or inspired about that, about how that's organized, but it's just a way to help us understand. I think the Waldrons, Bob and Sandra, originally developed that. I've heard of others that are maybe based on 16 periods or some variation, but we use those to set our study. And you can see it begins all the way in the very beginning, before the flood, which would have involved creation, all the way through the Old Testament, through the study of the patriarchs and the promises that were made to the patriarchs, Exodus from Egypt, wandering in the wilderness, and then invasion and conquest of the land, and then that leading to that period known as the kingdom, led by Saul initially, and then David and Solomon. And then, of course, that was followed by a division in the kingdoms between Israel and Judah. And then Israel eventually went away. We'll start kind of touch on that some today. And then that left Judah alone. Judah alone was unfaithful, so they went into captivity. And, of course, they were allowed to return from captivity, and we'll talk about that some today. Then we have a period known as years of silence of about 400 years, where there were no recorded revelations, and the Bible actually predicts that. And then we turn to a period known as, we're really emphasizing the life of Christ and then the church that resulted from his life, and then the various letters that were written to Christians. So you can see how that's organized. Today, again, we will notice probably more emphasis on the return from captivity and years of silence. I hope this is okay to read. You know, where we've been, we've been emphasizing, I'll have to turn around and look. We've gone through this cycle study where we've taken some time and looked at the various stories that comprise what we just talked about. Then we've kind of dug in a little bit on geography. Trent's had some just terrific studies and pictures and things to do with some of the things that he's been able to see. He and Rebecca have been able to see very interesting things. I don't have quite as interesting things like that. But again, we've studied the Genesis and the patriarchs. We studied some of the things we just talked about. Today, we'll be looking some at the Persian Empire and the return, some of the empires that existed at that time, world affairs during the years of silence, and some of that, Lord willing, will be covered on Wednesday. And then in about a week or so, we'll start studying the life of Christ more. It's just kind of remembering what we studied in the last couple of lessons. Remember, after the fall of Israel, again, this gets into the period where you have the divided kingdom, then Israel was unfaithful. Did Israel have any good kings? No good kings in Israel. Was Judah's record better or much better? Somewhat better, a little better, but still even Judah did not have that many good kings. And so went the king, so went the kingdom, right? The people very much followed the direction of the leadership of the kingdom in terms of their spirituality and their devotion to God. And that had long-lasting impacts. We talk about the Assyrians. The Assyrians were God's instruments to take away Israel ultimately after many warnings. The Assyrians kept detailed records that have been found. They were known for their cruelty. They conquered the area we would call Palestine and Syria en route to Egypt. And again, God used Israel as that means. You can see that kingdom ran eventually all the way down into Egypt. Of course, the area we would call Palestine, even further east, all the way to the Zagros Mountains and even up. So that's a very large kingdom that the Assyrians conquered. Well, really only two good kings that were part of the kings of Judah, only two that were really good. You remember what their names were? I think I have it up there. Hezekiah and Josiah. They would institute many reforms spiritually, but the others were wicked, and the kingdom followed that. But you see, at this time now, the extent of the control of the Assyrians, we just noticed that a minute ago. We see the establishment of Ashdod. And at times, some of these little kingdoms would rebel against Assyria, only to be put down. Hezekiah, of course, resisted Assyria, and God delivered, if you remember that story. We see the use of the term Jew, and again, sort of associated with Judah, it seems. A lot of words, it seems, that we see and that we encounter in the Bible story are kind of derivations of other words that we see. But we see the term Jew begin to be used. We'll see that a lot from here on out. And then we have the rise of the Medo-Persian Empire. Media becomes strong enough to eventually Assyria really starts to go downhill. There's no records from the Medes. But there are recorded records from Assyria and other places that mention the Medes. So we know, in addition to the Bible, that they definitely existed, even from a secular historical standpoint, confirms them as well. But we see the expansion now of Assyria, the expansion of Medo-Persia. But you have another kingdom that's still there. You have the Assyrian kingdom. You have the, of course, the Medo-Persian kingdom or empire. What was the other one that was still there? Who ultimately took Judah into captivity? Babylon. We see Babylon is still there. And of course, we've already encountered the great ruler known as Nebuchadnezzar. He really built Babylon into an incredible place. Even one of the seven ancient wonders of the world is attributed to Nebuchadnezzar, the Hanging Gardens. Well, he died in 562 BC. Well, at the same time, we have Cyrus, who is part of the Medes and the Persian. He rises to power in a little province known as Ashdod, and I may be mispronouncing that. And he actually goes and conquers, and I don't know how to pronounce that, Astyages, his grandfather, I believe, if I read that right. He conquers the capital of Ecbatana in about 550 BC. So we see now Cyrus is growing in power, and the Medo-Persians are growing in power. Well, Babylon begins to weaken, particularly under Nabonidus, which was one of the kingdoms. Not necessarily mentioned in the Bible. We see historical records of him. Nabonidus was frequently absent. Well, he has a son by the name of Belshazzar that you may have heard of, because he is mentioned in the Bible story, often ruled in his place. Well, one night, Belshazzar had a banquet. Do you remember what they were doing at that banquet? Drinking wine, and they were using the cups and the utensils that had been taken from the temple in Jerusalem. And I guess it kind of implies they knew what they were doing, right? So they were taking these utensils, things that had been dedicated to the service of God, that had been captured by them, and using them. Well, what happens while that banquet's going on? The event that inspires the term handwriting on the wall, right? What would we do if we're sitting here and a hand just started writing on that wall right there? I didn't hear what somebody said. Probably get up and run out. Yeah, I think I would too. Well, they're kind of amazed by it. What did it write? Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. Well, Daniel is brought in to interpret this. What did it mean? You've been weighed in the balance and been found wanting. God's balance. Imagine that story being brought to you by God. You've been weighed in the balance and been found wanting. What does a balance do? You put weights on one side and you use that to measure what's on the other side. And if it goes like that, you have an uneven distribution, right? Well, you're missing something up here. And that's what he's saying. Your kingdom is given to the Medes and the Persians. Do you remember how Daniel is rewarded? He's given a place of authority in the kingdom. What place was that? Was it second? You're close. Third. Third in the kingdom. Second would have kind of been the obvious guess, right? But it's third in the kingdom because Nabonidus is ruling. Belshazzar, a prince, his son, was ruling in his place. So he could not have given him third in the kingdom. The Bible, secular history corroborates the Bible in this situation. He could not have given him second in the kingdom, but he could have given him third, which is what he did. Well, fortified, a very massive, impressive place. Who had had a role in that? Nebuchadnezzar. The wall said to be massive walls. And it was fortified, so it was hard, almost impenetrable. But the Euphrates River ran into the city. And they had constructed the walls in such a way that the river water would run under the walls. Of course, that would be a natural protection, right, against enemies. You know, even if you could go into the water, you have to go under these walls. Well, you can't take an army through there, right, because your army would drown. So what ingenious thing did Cyrus's men do? Yeah, they actually dug or took advantage of some already dug canals and broke those such that that water began to divert, and the water level of the Euphrates River diverted into a marsh, and it dropped, and his troops went right in. And Belshazzar that very night, and I've even seen an exact date, October 29th or something like that, according to secular history, he died that night. He was slain that night. Catch up my charts here. I want you to look at some prophecies about Babylon. And again, this is just a sampling. There are some others with respect to Babylon. Written 150, I hope you can see that, 150 years or so, 160, 175 years in advance of when they occurred. To the point that secular critics believe that somebody came in later on and added details to the story to make it match secular history. That's how accurate this is. Isaiah, the 44th chapter, verse 27. Again, I realize this is hard to read. Who says to the watery deep, be dry, and I will dry up your streams? Who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd? He's talking about Cyrus 150 or so years in advance, calls him by name. Isaiah 13, verse 17 through 22. This is a longer reading. Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them. If you look at Isaiah 13, it's talking about Babylon. I will stir up the Medes against them, who will not regard silver, and as for gold, delight in it. Also their bow will dash the young men to pieces. They will have no pity on the fruit of the womb. Their eye and will not spare children. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It will never be inhabited, nor will it be settled from generation to generation, nor will the Arabian pitch tents there, nor will the shepherds make their sheepholds there. But wild beasts of the desert will lie there, and their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches will dwell there, and wild goats will caper there. The hyenas will howl in their citadels, and the jackals in their pleasant palaces. Her time is near to come, and her days will not be prolonged. Speaking of Babylon, let me show you some pictures of the ruins of Babylon. This was taken, I believe, by, in 1970 or so by Farrell Jenkins. If you're familiar with Farrell Jenkins, he's traveled extensively. Since that time, I believe Saddam Hussein, who ruled over Iraq, actually tried to build his palace near this area and maybe reconstructed a few places, but nobody lives there. And here is a picture, if I remember right, when I pulled this out of Farrell Jenkins' online resource, and he gives permission for people to use it for purposes such as we're doing, but it is his picture. He took that picture. Oh, let me go back. This is a quote from Jeremiah. Babylon shall become a heap of ruins, the haunt of jackals, a hall and a hissing without inhabitant. It has never been re-inhabited, and it never will be, because God said that it will not. All these years, and even efforts by people to try to do that, have been unsuccessful. Saddam Hussein was unsuccessful. And he tried to build a palace that overlooked this area with the idea, I believe, of reestablishing it. God means what he says. When God says something, you can count on it. And that should be a warning to us today about what God says with respect to how we live. This is a picture of what is known as the Ishtar Gate. And Trent, you may have to help me with some of the details here, but as I understand it, it was moved from its original site and reconstructed, and I'm sure there were some things added to make it look the way that it does now. These were wood kiln type of bricks that were painted with a glazed blue. Very impressive thing that was part of Babylon, now resides in Berlin. It was reconstructed in Berlin, Germany, in a museum there. Moved from its original site years ago from Babylon. Impressive. Babylon was an impressive place. Was an impressive power with lots of power. Even Nebuchadnezzar himself attributed how great this was. Remember him that I have built. I don't remember exactly how he worded it. I have built up this great impressive place. Well, God brought him down a few notches, did he not? Well, recall the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had that we read about in Daniel, the second chapter. Remember, there were four world empires that were prophesied. It did not talk about the Assyrians because at this point, we're moving on to Babylon and then further. But of course, you have this image that had a head of gold. And I have to tell you, I had to modest him up some. He was revealing more than I was comfortable having in here, but in terms of his legs and chest and things like that. So I added a few details to kind of make him a little more modest than he was in that picture. Hopefully I've succeeded. He had a head of gold, chest of silver, a belly and thighs of bronze, some versions say brass, and then feet of iron and clay mixed. And that head of gold represented Babylon. And Daniel even tells Nebuchadnezzar that, does he not? Chest of silver, the Medo-Persians who were coming after them. Belly and thighs of bronze were the Grecian Empire. We'll talk about the Grecian Empire here in a minute. And of course, we understand through secular history and through the Bible itself, really, that the feet of toes the feet and toes of iron and clay mix represented Rome, the Roman Empire. What was special about that one? What happened during the days of the Roman Empire? Broke up, and what was God going to do with respect to his kingdom? In the days of these kings, God was going to establish his eternal kingdom that we're a part of today. Jesus came to earth. He went into heaven. He reigns in heaven today. We are a part of his kingdom. We are citizens of his kingdom as Christians. We are a part of that today. And that was predicted all the way back during that time. And of course, we've been emphasizing today really Babylon and the Medo-Persians. Well, God's people were living under the rule of Cyrus. Now, even though he did and did not, you know, there were some bad things that happened and people were killed in terms of how he overtook. He did not engage in mass killings or imprisonment of captives to the extent that other rulers did. Instead, prominent men in Babylon were given positions of authority. And I believe Darius the Mede was actually appointed to be ruler of the area that would have included Babylon. Well, Daniel is still there all these years later. And I think I saw it. Someone said that if Daniel had been 16 when the captivity began, about what that would that make him now? Well over 80, right? As we're approaching now that 70-year period. What was special about the 70-year period? Yeah, that's how long that Jeremiah had spoken concerning the captivity. The people of Judah went into captivity. Remember that list of periods that we showed and we talked about captivity? Well, Israel was already gone. Judah was only left. Well, Judah was unfaithful. They went into captivity. And here's this 70-year captivity that we're talking about. Daniel prayed to God and confessed the sins of the people. He asked God to restore Israel back since these 70 years were about up. And I'm paraphrasing. Well, had God forgotten? No. No, God is not like people. When God issues a promise, you can count on it. And that's exactly what happened. In 538 BC, Cyrus issues an edict. And I forgive the typo there. It says edit. I should say, should be E-D-I-C-T. Which allowed all and displaced people to return to their homelands. That, of course, included the Jews that had been scattered. So after 70 years, just as the Bible had predicted, the Israelites are returned, allowed to return home. Do you remember about how many came in the first wave associated with Zerubbabel? Of people returning from Babylon back to Israel? Roughly 50,000. 42,000 plus others. I think servants and things like that that came with them. But some stayed where they were. You can imagine if you've lived somewhere for a long period of time such as this, including some at 70 years, some had been born and raised children there and probably had seen a couple of generations. They were pretty well established in that life, were they not? And it would have been hard to pick up and leave. And some actually did remain. But 50,000 initially returned. There'll actually be three waves in terms of this return. Many of those vessels that we talked about a few minutes ago that they were using in that banquet with Belshazzar, many of those will return. I think it was numbered in the about 5,000 or so of those articles were brought back. And we have people who still lived in the region of Judah, right? I mean, as time was marching on, that place, that area of Judah wasn't just completely uninhabited. And there were all sorts of people who were around. You have Samaritans and Edomites and Ammonites, other nomadic tribes. And Arabs were in the regions of Judah. And they went back and they began to rebuild what first? Well, the temple, but really something before the temple that was essential to offering sacrifices. Altar of burnt offering. Altar of burnt offering. They actually laid the foundations of the temple. Well, as I mentioned, we had people in that area, other peoples, other tribes, other nations that were sort of in that area. What did they think about this? This reconstruction effort that's starting. Were they okay with that? No. In fact, they sought efforts to stop it. In fact, part of their justification was, you look back, and I don't remember if it's Cambyses, I believe it is. Cyrus is dead by this point. I believe it's his son Cambyses, and I may be mispronouncing that. who is now ruler. And so they go back to him and they say, hey, you need to put a stop to this, because these people, every time that they've grown in power and reestablished their temple, they're going to be trouble. And they were successful. Construction was halted and the temple sat unfinished for 16 years. Well, the Persian Empire during this time continues to expand. And either Darius or Darius, however you want to pronounce that, the Great, becomes ruler. He actually divided up the empire into 20 satrapies or satraps. That term will come in play with the book of Esther. You can see the satrap of Abarhanara, which would have included the area of Judah and Palestine, Samaria. That would have been where God's people had resided. So they're divided up into these districts. So time marches on. I mean, you've got to live and eat, and you're raising a family. Even though you've left Babylon and you've moved down, you're going to make a life for yourself, right? You've got to raise a family, and you've got to build a home. And you can kind of get comfortable doing that. And meanwhile, what's going on with the temple? Nothing. Nothing. So the prophets Haggai and Zechariah encouraged the people to resume work on the temple. I believe it even says, you know, you're living in paneled houses, and God's temple sits desolate. I believe it's how it words it. So Darius was shown the original decree from Cyrus, and he actually allows it to resume. Okay, so they go back and they're allowed to resume temple construction. And about 20 years after construction began, the temple was finished. This temple would not have been as glorious as the original temple. In fact, when they were laying the foundations, some of their folks cried when they saw it, because it paled in terms of comparison to the original temple. But they at least do have a temple. We see this, Xerxes comes to power. The story of Esther takes place during this time period. Artaxerxes comes to power. And then we encounter someone named Ezra, who is sent back to assess religious conditions in Judah and Jerusalem. We have Nehemiah. What was Nehemiah's big thing? Rebuilding the walls. But even then, the Jews had not been following God. And then, for a period of 400 years, Revelation ceases. And the Bible predicts that. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will send a famine on the land. Not a famine of bread, nor a thirst for water, but of the hearing of the words of the Lord of the temple. That's from Amos, the 8th chapter. Well, the prophecies concerning Jesus and the Messiah were still there, were they not? They had been prophesied. The book of Isaiah and many other passages talked about a coming Messiah. And the people, the Jews, knew that. They expected that. They were awaiting the fullness of time that we talk about, that's talked about in the New Testament. But they were still very negligent in keeping God's commands, at least for part of this time. Then you get to the time of Christ, where they had established intricate rules, even almost ridiculous rules, in an effort to try to make sure they kept the commands of God. They created rules and laws through their traditions that had gone overboard. So we see sort of a shift in that thinking amongst the Jews. Well, the Persian Empire continues for about 100 years into that period of silence. And then they began clashing with the Greeks, who were growing in power. And then we encounter, this is, of course, during the days of biblical silence, Alexander the Great, one of the greatest rulers who ever lived. He's appointed regent of Greece at age 16. He becomes ruler at age 20. Why is it important to know this? Because going back to that chart we showed earlier of the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw that predicted these successive kingdoms. Alexander the Great is the fulfillment of the third kingdom, the kingdom of bronze, of belly and thighs of bronze. He defeated Persia, conquered lands that had been controlled by the Persians. One thing that Alexander did that the Greeks were very interested in is promoting their culture and their education, their language. And despite how great Alexander was, it was short-lived. He died of a fever at age 32, and then power fell to four of his generals. And the Grecian kingdom really became initially four separate mini-kingdoms. And I guess that was prophesied in the Bible as well, in the book of Daniel. If you look at some of those, I believe it's Daniel 11 that talks about this. But these generals shared Alexander's vision of promoting the Hellenistic culture. Sometimes that term's used, Hellenistic, you think of Greece when you think of that. And there was resistance to that from the Jews. Many would refuse to go along with it. But over time, that culture and that language and that influence really became very strong. And people of God fell into that as well, right? This idea of speaking Greek. We'll just show you. Of the four empires, two became a bit more strong than the other. Down in Egypt, the Ptolemies. The Syrian or the Seleucid Empire was over here. And I can't remember exactly how they're rephrased over here, but you see the Macedonian Empire, I believe it is, again. And the fourth, I can't remember exactly where it is, but initially it was four. Then it became really more or less two that became more powerful, and they fought against one another. And who's caught in the middle? The Palestine, God's people are caught in the middle and often encountered the different clashes between these two empires. So I thought that was interesting as well. So going back to that the chart I showed earlier with respect to Daniel, the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw, we're now seeing the fulfillment of that third empire, and that was Greece. How much time do we have left? 4 minutes. Let me stop for a moment. I've been talking nonstop, and I'll give you an opportunity to offer any comments that you might want to make with respect to this story. Too much information? I kind of felt that way last night when I was trying to get prepared. It is a lot of information. Again, we're not going into all the details because we'll hit these a bit more thoroughly when we go through our detailed study over the next several years. All right, if there are other questions, we'll pick up and talk more about the Grecian culture and the impact that that had. Lord willing, on Wednesday. Thank you.